Good afternoon, and welcome to today's broadcast of the Fireside Chats, presented by the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society, and broadcast on www.sechistorical.org. I'm Teresa Gabaldon, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law, and moderator of the Fireside Chats. The SEC Historical Society preserves and shares the history of securities regulation through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is free and accessible worldwide at all times. The virtual museum and archive, as well as the Society, are separate from and independent of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. They receive no government funding. We are thankful for the gifts and grants from the many institutions and individuals who make possible the growth and outreach of the virtual museum and archive. Today's program launches our 2009 broadcast season and is one in a series of fireside chats looking at the distinctive history and work of many of the major SEC divisions and offices. This series is a part of the Society's commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the SEC this year. Last year, the Fireside Chats focused on the work of the SEC Office of the General Counsel, the Office of International Affairs, the Regional Offices, the Division of Enforcement, and the Office of Compliance Inspections and Examinations. The Society's annual meeting examined the Division of Investment Management. All of these programs can be accessed again in the online programs section of the museum. Today's Fireside Chat looks at the SEC Division of Corporation Finance, popularly known as CorpFin. I'm delighted to welcome Alan Berkeley of K&L Gates, who is joining us by telephone from London, and Martin Dunn of O'Melveny & Myers. Their remarks today are solely their own and are not representative of the Society. They cannot give legal or investment advice. Before we begin, however, I'd like to take a moment to commend the work of the Corporation Finance Advisory Group, which has been working together since 2003 to ensure that the history and people of the SEC Division of Corporation Finance have been included in the museum's collections. This group is led by David Martin and Mickey Beach and includes Paul Belvin, Edward Green, Justin Klein, William Morley, Peter Romeo, and Richard Rowe. Elise Walter, now an SEC commissioner, was also active with the group. We're grateful for their input in developing today's program. Alan and Martin, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First, I'd very much appreciate it if you could each take a moment to describe your respective personal histories with CorpFin.
I'll start and then let Alan go next because he's much older than I am. It'll take him longer. I started in CorpFin in 1988, right out of law school, as an examiner. I worked for Jeff Riedler in one of the groups and was reviewing filings for a couple of years and was lucky enough to move over to the chief counsel's office, which I very much enjoyed, and was chief counsel there and basically held a bunch of different jobs for the next 20 years and left in 2007. I was deputy director when I left.
Well, as you read off the list of the people on your advisory committee from CorpFin, I fully recognize that I'm not one of them, and perhaps that's because I've never worked at CorpFin. I think I'm one of those few securities lawyers, particularly in Washington, who practiced before the commission and with the folks in CorpFin for all around 40 years now and have never been employed by the SEC in any capacity whatsoever. That's notwithstanding the fact that any number of staff people have objected to my comments asserting that I had stated contrary views when I was at the commission.
I'd appreciate it if one of you could get us rolling along by describing in general terms the mission of the division.
I'll tell you, I've always thought it's very basic. The Division of CorpFin is all about disclosure. That really is what it comes down to. The entire role is geared towards making sure that companies are able to comply with the registration process and the disclosure requirements. A lot of time is spent helping them comply in reality. And so the focus is making sure that investors get information from those companies at the time when it's useful. And that is the primary focus. It's not merit-based. It's nothing else. It's based on disclosure.
Has it been there since the very beginning, that is, when the SEC first came into existence? Was there a division of CorpFin?
Alan may have been there, but I wasn't there at the time. But the Division of Corporation Finance, from what I can gather, came about during the Second World War. there are some annual reports there where the division name disappears for a couple of years, so I was never sure if it was 42 or 43. Before that, it was called the Division of Registration, and it moved from that to being Corp Fin. I always think of that as the division that became Corp Fin, because the director stayed the same, getting Baldwin Bain, stayed the same between the two. So I figure some of the jobs were split up in different places before, but I always considered that to be the place it started from.
And you said that it's all about disclosure. Could you be just a little bit more specific about what the average attorney in the Division of Corp Fin does, if there is such a thing as an average attorney?
It's like Lake Wobegon. They're all above average. They're all above average. It's split up. If you take the division, probably 80% of it does that core work that I just talked about, reviewing registration statements, reviewing 10-Ks, reviewing proxy statements, really looking at disclosure from an accounting, from a legal side, making sure it complies, it's got everything that's supposed to be in there, making sure it's clear, all the things they do. Interestingly, that's the bulk of the work, and that is truly the genius of the division, is that part. And yet the part everybody always wants to talk about is the flip side at conferences, the rulemaking part, the interpretive part, the M&A group or the international group or the chief accountant. And really those are support offices that help the main function. The main function is the disclosure entity that is the operating groups that are run by an assistant director and have the industries in them and just review filings.
I think that it's important to recognize that Corp Fin is, in many respects, the public face of the commission to the vast bulk of lawyers and company executives who are in the process of raising capital or in compliance, once they're public in the compliance process. My guess would be that the staff lawyers in Corp Fin have more exposure to the real world and to companies and counsel and accountants than the staff in almost any other division of the commission, except maybe enforcement, where it's, at least we could hope, a smaller subset. The result of it is that this Corp Fin staff conducts itself in a way that needs to conduct itself and does conduct itself in a way that gives confidence of its capabilities to the counsel and companies and accountants with which it deals. And in a lot of respects, I think, on the disclosure side particularly, are really the most important part of the commission because of that public face. It leads to some of the frustrations that the bar has. When you asked a moment ago, what's the mission of the division, I almost said facetiously to make life miserable for securities lawyers. That's not the case, because the mission of the division is to be the public face and to make life easier to securities lawyers who are attempting to comply with the rules.
I would agree totally. The amount of time, even as a very new attorney or a new accountant, you spend on the phone with people is much more than you anticipate when you go in, and it is a great teaching device. You have to be confident enough to have a conversation on a topic that is one of 20 things you're dealing with, and you're having it with oftentimes 2, 3, 4, 5 people on the phone who are focused very much on this, and you have to have the confidence to get up there and explain where you're coming from and where you want the outcome to be and how to work towards it. And having to have that confidence, you've got to learn very quickly. And I enjoyed that a lot. I didn't always win all the battles. That's the nature of the game. But I think that also teaches you part of how to get to the practical solutions that the division's pretty well known for.
It sounds as though the mission has been consistent within your respective experiences, 20, 40 years, whatever. Is that true? Do you see anything different about the commission's mission today than it was some number of years ago?
For the division, I think it has always been about the one thing, which is the disclosure. I think it's taken on responsibilities that go around that. As I said, the interpretive part, more day-to-day stuff. You see the division doing maybe 30 or 40 years ago, more interpretations were made maybe by the Office of General Counsel or the Chief Accountant's Office made more decisions that affected day-to-day stuff more. I think you've seen the division grow in day-to-day interpretations around that, and the GC and the Chief Accountant do more broader pronouncements and less day-to-day stuff. But really, the core function is always the same, and nobody else does it. It needs to be there.
Yeah, and there's no question at all that one of the gravitational pulls in recent years has been toward rulemaking. As Marty and I were chatting some time ago, we're dealing with a statute that's 75 years old or thereabouts that has not been significantly amended in terms of its conceptual underpinnings. And yet the world has changed, the needs for the review process have changed, and the division has responded remarkably, without any statutory changes, to adapt to the new world, often in ways that are very creative, very clever, sometimes controversial, sometimes they work better than other times. But there's been a remarkable degree of creativity and flexibility, really, I would guess, probably over the last 25 years.
I can think of a couple of instances of true creativity, and the one that comes first to my mind was a long time ago. That was the custom of the delaying amendment. Would one of you be able to talk about what that is, how it came about, and would there be some other way to get to the same place?
Well, the delaying amendment is a very cool thing. And when you look at the statute, as Alan said, they really haven't changed much. And the statute was really built towards the notion of a registration statement coming in, it getting a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and then 20 days later it's done. You know, within 20 days it gets a thumbs up or a thumbs down. As you'll read the history of the agency, and that's my only basis for knowing it because I wasn't there, everybody realized that just wasn't going to work. You couldn't give a thumbs up. You were going to wind up giving so many thumbs down because it wasn't quite right. So they developed this practical process whereby you'd get comments, and then every 19th day you'd file an amendment, which restarts your 20-day clock. And then so people realized, well, let's just find a way where you automatically do that. And so they adopted the rule that deems, if you put this certain language on the cover, it will be deemed to automatically be amended every 19th day and restart the clock. And the beauty of that is the 20 days is the outside. So you can always be shorter. You request acceleration. The company requests acceleration. So once you get to a process where the only way it can really go effective is through this request for acceleration, then you've created this interactive process where the company and the staff have to get on the same page and realize and come to an agreement that they've gotten where they need to be in order to have it go effective for it to work. And so I think the delaying amendment is like a lot of other things you'll see in rulemaking, where it starts out of a staff process and then it gets codified as you go on. If you look at, I mean, there's so many places with, you know, 430A and part of the 415, the shelf stuff, or even parts of 144 that have been added as years have gone on. What you have is the staff takes what's there, figures out a way that it works, and then once that gets all set and some of the kinks are worked out, then it becomes a rule. How many rules do you see where it's codifying a staff interpretation? Something like that. And so I think the delaying amendment's a classic example of taking a statute saying, this doesn't work, but we can't shut everything down and say every 20 days you get a stop order from everybody. Now, remember, back in those days, every registration statement went to the commission for a vote up or down before it went effective. Imagine trying to do that now. You know, the thousands that come in just couldn't happen. So the realization of that and creating a process that then became codified in rules is exactly what the division does and does pretty well. And it's a good way to do it because you get to work the kinks out.
Mm-hmm.
Beforehand instead of after.
Don't forget that from the issuer side, there's always the option of pulling the delaying amendment.
Mm-hmm.
A threat made far more frequently than ever executed on. But there are circumstances in which the frustration level in dealing with the division and in trying to get something through for whatever reason has broken down. The frustration level is high. And it's a good attention-getting device. It's sort of like a temper tantrum. It's a very good attention-getting device to just send a letter in and file it and pull the delaying amendment. And at that point, the division's got 20 days to make a decision whether they're going to put in a stop order, seek a stop order, or they're going to let it go effective by the passage of time.
Right. And the acceleration point, another part of that I find to be brilliant in it is technically the staff can't deny an acceleration request. It can only grant it. So if a company comes in and says, no, I want acceleration tomorrow, it's only the commission can deny it. Does that ever happen? No, because the process has developed such that it works. It works from both sides. The staff realizes what their responsibilities are, and companies, in the vast majority, realize that the process is there to get them to the end. And so it works very well, but I don't think a lot of people realize that on the acceleration part, that if push came to shove, the staff can't actually say no. They can say, well, let's think about it. They can work through the process, but it makes it an interactive process, which is what this needs to be.
Marty, talking about interactive processes, what about bed bugs, and what about those situations where something comes in and the staff thinks it's simply inadequate to meet the statutory requirements?
The bed bug letter, and you know, there are a lot of different stories about where it comes from. I'm not going to pretend to know that. But that's the process where a registration statement comes in, and the first round of comments is simply, we're not even going to comment. You're not even close enough for us to start. And I think that that's an important part of it, because the staff is there to help, but the staff's not there to write the thing for you. And if a registration statement comes in with no financials in it, what's the sense in raising a bunch of comments when you have to start over again? So the process of saying, this is so bad, we're not even going to start, I think you need to have. How it got the name of the bed bug letter, I don't know, but I think it has become very descriptive, and everybody knows what it is. But it's an important part of it, and it's all because it's a process. And if one side is going to break down on it, you need to be able to draw the line.
Do you have a sense that the bar has learned, and that the issuer community has learned, and that there are fewer and fewer totally inadequate filings?
Yeah, you don't see many bed bug letters at all. It's much, much more the exception than the rule. I mean, you couldn't imagine the small number. You would think that there would be a lot more, but you got to be pretty bad to get that one.
This sounds like something of a celebration of collaboration between the division and the practicing bar, with perhaps the occasional temper tantrum thrown in. I'm curious, I want to press you a little bit on that. Would you truly describe the attitude as one of collaboration?
The answer is no. And let me start that way, particularly to be provocative. I think that there's historically, and years ago, and when I started, especially in the review process, there was a very high level of collaboration, high level of trust between the practicing bar and the staff, a very good exchange of ideas and concerns and issues, and actually, I think over time, some very good and close working relationships. My sense is that over time, that has broken down, and that we, of late and now, are in a period where there's a high level of distrust of the bar by the staff, and a higher level of frustration by the bar in dealing with the staff because of the lack of flexibility and understanding. And the bar would often say training and creativity on the part of the staff and an unwillingness to work with each other. I can recall situations some years ago where it was fairly routine for outside practitioners to come to the commission and teach securities regulation to the CorpFin staff, and be part of a series of seminars or a series of programs where you check your client at the door, they check their client at the door, and you sit and you have a discussion about the process and the law and how it works. My guess is that something like that hasn't occurred for years and years and years. My sense, at least, is that this level of hostility would probably overstate it, but frustration and distrust really has developed in the last 20 years, let's say, and shows no sign of decline now. And I think that's terribly, terribly unfortunate. And I can't put my finger on the source of it or where it began. But I do know, and I do feel very strongly, that it has broken down in that relationship. I have some sense that it broke down initially on the rulemaking side and not on the review process side. But I'm not entirely certain of that.
You know, my experience with it, and maybe I was there 20 years, so maybe it started breaking down when I showed up, but is when I first got there, the folks on the staff were much more willing. I can remember being in a lot of phone calls where we would just call people who used to be on the staff and if we had something we weren't aware of, we would have a real discussion, say, what are people doing? You know, how are people doing this? How are people on the outside perceiving this requirement? How are they complying with it? You know, we don't want to be making things up as we go along. We want to be figuring it out. And those conversations were not infrequent. And I think Alan's right. You started seeing in the early 90s and in the mid-90s on a lot of the rulemakings, the comment letters started coming back from the bar with less of helpful, here's how we think this fits within the statute, we don't think this furthers the purpose of the statute, those kind of comments. And you started getting more and more of, give us more. It became a, we're representing our clients in this comment rather than we're working on getting to what is the right answer under the purpose of the statute. And I know, and I sense frustration on that. I do know that on the side of interacting between the staff and the bar, you see a huge change in my mind during the dot-com bubble. Because all of a sudden, you go from everybody's trying to get good disclosure out there, we're trying to get the right answer, to, oh, come on, you're just in the way, everybody's making money. And so the staff is trying to keep doing its job, but everybody's viewing it as in the way of them making money. Now, it turns out if they'd actually read what they'd been reading, they might have realized it. But I know that at that point in time, one, the quality of the lawyering got a lot worse because everybody was doing it. Firms were stretched so thin, they were putting people in with no experience. So the quality of the lawyering from the outside was bad. It was not as good. There were so many filings, the staff was stretched thin. And the bar just saw us as in the way. And I had more than one conversation during that period of time when I was told things I knew that weren't right. And I knew that they were just either telling me what they wanted me to hear or telling me what they thought I wanted to hear and wanted to move on. And also at that time, you saw a breakdown in the gatekeepers who used to perform a function. The underwriters who used to value a company, put a value on it, all of a sudden it became a company's worth whatever it's worth. Just put the thing out there. Sell it. And I think you saw a real problem that came out of that period of time because you saw the staff push to its limits and not always helped. And I think that that hasn't completely gone away. And you still see all the time now the notion of, yeah, that's what they told me, but do I believe it? Whereas when I started, there was much more of an interaction, and maybe it was a smaller universe. So it was people you knew better or whatever, but I don't want to, I think Alan goes a little far.
We sound like a couple of old fuddies.
I think Alan goes a little far saying that it's not a good relationship. I think it's still a good relationship, but I think the level of trust has decreased a little bit in it. I think that's the way of the world. You know, yeah. There's a lot of money to be had. There are a lot of people after it, and the staff's trying to do its job.
Marty, I think you triggered something that I thought of occasionally over the years, and that is how the role of the underwriter, the investment bankers, has changed, starting maybe at some point during the dot-com or whichever bubble it was. My recollection in the old days, speaking like an old fuddy-duddy, was that it was always the underwriter and the investment banker who was busy putting caution into the registration statement and concerned about overspeaking and overstating. And somewhere, and the company would be fighting with the underwriters to get in to tell their story and to sell the securities. And I kind of noticed over the 90s a shift in that to where the underwriters were the go-go guys, mm-hmm. and the companies and management were the people sitting there saying, hey, I'm the one who's got liability for this, and we're being the more cautious. I don't know if that's something that the staff would have picked up during that period or not.
I definitely picked it up.
Clear evolution over the years.
Well, and you also saw it right around that period of time when the underwriters were pushing the staff to allow them to circulate prospectuses without a price range in it.
Right.
And I think that was a big change. Once you went from you have to have a range that you have to live with to, well, you can kind of circulate so long as you come back with a range in enough time before you go effective. All of a sudden, their notion of valuing a company and putting it out there at that price went away, and it became, you know, it's an eBay society. What it's worth what you'll pay me, and then we'll set the range after we know what people will pay us. And I saw that as a very big change. And you know, you saw changes at the same time that led to FD along the lines of companies were giving all the analysts and the like information that then they had an advantage over everybody, and that's, that seemed unfair and still bothers me that that became just the way of the time. And so it's easy to be a genius when you already know the answer. And I found that that time changed a lot of things, and not for the better.
In retrospect, do you think that there's anything that the division of Corp Fin might have done to avert the dot-com bubble?
The thing I think we could have done, as I said, allowing people to circulate without ranges, I think was a problem. But at the same time, there was just so much money to be had. And as I said, we're about disclosure, not about merit. We wouldn't have stopped them so long as the disclosure was complete. And you know what? The disclosure was complete. They were saying, we don't really do anything. We have an idea. Give us $100 million. And so while I think there could a few little things that we could have done there, I think it would have been more towards making the gatekeepers do their jobs a little bit more than they did. But there was so much going on so fast, I don't know if they could have.
I would probably agree. There are always going to be these bubbles. You know, there's a long history of them, and Galbraith wrote about them. And you sit there and say, you're going to have this kind of excitement and exuberance and quick money, and it comes, and there's very little that the staff or the commission can do about it, nor is it particularly the commission's role to try to inhibit capital formation, because it just wants to slow it down and think about it a little bit more if the disclosure is good. The issue in the 90s, I think, was that the prospectuses probably weren't so bad and they weren't so sloppy. They may have had a certain cookie-cutter mentality to them, but people wanted into those deals. They wanted to make the money. They wanted the transactions. A lot of people made a lot of money in them. And you can't sit there and say that it was a problem in the prospectuses. I can remember when Plain English was coming on board, I was assigned on some program to argue the side against Plain English.
And what did you say?
Which was sort of fun. It was at a NASA convention, and where I had a very sympathetic audience, as you can imagine. And I was given that side to argue, but the essential point was there that nobody reads it. And in fact, we're writing prospectuses in that era, as in any other, from mom and pop sitting around a fire, you know, a Franklin stove in Nebraska, when they're not reading it, and probably nobody is reading it, and if anybody is reading it or was reading it, it was the analysts who were looking at the value of looking at the technology and making a decision on their own as to whether they thought it had a future. So I don't pin the dot-com bubble on the commission any more than, frankly, I pin Enron on Corp Fin.
And that was one of the frustrating parts of being in the division at that time. Everybody was on us to get out of the way so people could make their money. And then as soon as it went bad, everybody was on us asking us where we were and why we weren't more in the way. So it's the no-win part of bureaucracy.
I do think the Enrons of the world and some of these other offerings of hybrid and derivative securities really do trigger an issue, and that is, does anyone understand them?
Mm-hmm.
And can the comment process begin to address, is the staff adequate and sufficiently knowledgeable to address some very, very complicated securities when, frankly, I'm not always certain that the people who create them fully understand the implications of them.
Yeah, and the interesting thing with the derivative securities is the people who create them and talk about them, some of them are quite brilliant and understand them, but certainly all the folks who use them and are not fully aware of their risks. And the worst part about it is the folks who create them and use them use a different language than a Securities Act or an Exchange Act language. They refer to things as longs and shorts instead of buys and sells, and they use terms that are not Corp Fin terms, and the difficulty is walking through and translating the language, and I don't think there are enough people who are capable of translating the language to make sure that everybody understands them. I couldn't agree with Alan Moore. I think if there was a pot of money that somebody went to Corp Fin and said, spend this the most useful way, I think the most useful way would be to find people. I mean, there's some people out of work right now. Would be to find people who truly understand derivatives and truly can get into, particularly at the financial institutions and at the folks who use derivatives more than others, and truly get into that disclosure and translate the language, make sure, and then retranslate it back out, make sure that the disclosure adequately reflects the risk. The requirements are there to discuss the risks, and the staff pushes people on it all the time. But I think that, and this is not a knock on the staff, it's the general nature of the industry, people don't understand derivatives as well as they should, and so the disclosure isn't as good as it could be. And that is the one place I truly think that there could be money well spent, because what causes things to break down now? It's systemic breakdowns that are what people are worried about. And where you don't fully understand the extent of risks is where you don't understand the potential for the systemic problems. And so I think that's one area where everybody could get a lot better at.
Now, on the other hand, do you think that's an issue for CorpFin or an issue for whatever they call market reg these days?
I actually think it mainly, to my mind, it's both. You've got to worry about the markets. You've got to worry about market risk. But at the same time, CorpFin's job is to help companies give people the information they need to understand the risks involved in an investment. And so I think that is part of their obligation, is to really get to that credit risk and the potential for a small amount of what looks like a small thing on a balance sheet to exponentially affect a company.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about the disclosure of risks and in the same conversation is also talking about exuberance, et cetera. And certainly something I've read many times over the years is that the division forces registrants to take a negative tone, and that prospectuses are far more negative now than they ever were in the past. Do you think that that's true? And if so, why has it happened?
I'll let Alan start because I'm going to rant.
I don't think that's true at all. I think when I started writing prospectuses, they were the most negative, ridiculous thing in the whole world. And you could not even talk about anything other than past history. It was absolutely, positively forbidden to put into a prospectus any expectations, any business plans, any hopes. You simply talked about the past. And then you asked investors to make an investment decision based upon what had occurred previously. That has changed radically into the 80s and since then, where we now value and force forward-looking information and trend and uncertainty disclosure, so that I think that it is not nearly so negative as it was 30 years ago and before. Having said that, let's be candid and recognize that a prospectus and a 10-K are liability documents. And if you're going to say it, you've got to have a very high degree of confidence in the accuracy of what you're saying, and properly build in proper cautionary language to deal with those parts that are forward-looking. But I think we've come a very long way. I can remember, slightly off to this question, but I can remember being chewed out as badly as I've ever been attacked by a regulator because I had the temerity to put on the front cover of a preliminary prospectus the company's logo.
Well, what were you thinking?
I don't know where. You know, it was 10-point unleaded, so on plain white paper. And I was a young lawyer, and I thought my license is going to be taken away, and they're going to shoot me out back of the building. Today you can pick up a prospectus, if there are any these days, and they're in multicolor, and they've got pictures, and they've got logos, and, you know, they keep going. So, yeah, I think it's a liability document, but I think we've come a very long and positive way in the last generation or so.
I would say, and the interesting part about it is I was very involved in plain English when we were doing that. And one of the debates in plain English was the need to repeat information over and over and over again and make the document virtually unreadable, or to have a million risk factors, even though they might not apply and weren't very clearly spelled out. And our goal on the staff was always chop down the risk factors to the ones that apply. Make the summary tight. Don't repeat the document in the summary. Make it a readable document. And unbelievable amounts of pushback. Oh, we'll get sued if we don't disclose it until page 30. Where does it say that? Nowhere. So the commission had to come out and say, we won't sue you if it's not until page 30, and in fact, we'll defend you if somebody does. And we had to do things like that. It is just the nature of lawyers. The staff encourages MD&A, you can argue, requires forward-looking information. So you get the Reform Act that gives you the safe harbor. You get Bespeak's caution. And the notion of the safe harbor is you put in a good, you know, introductory language, cautionary language that says, here are our forward-looking statements, here's why they might not be true, and then say whatever you want. You know, you've warned people, you can go forward, as long as you have some basis for it, right? Well, what happened? You didn't get more forward-looking statements. You got huge cautionary languages in case, God forbid, I accidentally made a forward-looking statement. So part of the nature of it is, I think the negativism is the class actions, the litigation stuff. I don't think it's the staff at all, really. I think the staff would much prefer if documents were much more easily read. We fought tooth and nail for plain English and in some ways succeeded, in some ways failed. But it was a nonstop fight to get lawyers to change things from the way it had worked. And once something works, well, you can always be a little safer, and then it accretes, and it accretes, and it accretes. And you've got these documents that, you know, tells you why everything in it might be wrong and then doesn't really tell you as much. That's an overstatement, of course. There's a lot of information in there. But I don't think it's the staff making negative. Now, when the staff reads something and it says in the footnotes of the financial statements, we'll be bankrupt in a month, and you don't read that anywhere else, well, they'll make you say that. But for the most part, I don't think they're overly focused on negativism. In fact, I spend a great deal of time, and a lot of people spend a great deal of time, trying to get folks to remove risk factors because they're really generic and don't apply. And the companies will say, well, what if it comes up and then we've taken it out and look what you've done to us? So they won't. So I think I wouldn't put that on the staff.
Would you say that the staff had a strong position with respect to this Bespeak's caution safe harbors?
I was there. I was in the chief counsel's office when the Trump decision first came out. And I remember thinking that was about the worst thing that had ever happened. You know, just in my mind, just thinking, they told you it might be wrong, so then you're not liable if it's wrong. Oh, my God, this is horrible. You know, and I remembered thinking, that's going to get overturned. Oh, that'll, you know, nobody will ever buy that. That's just crazy talk. And you know what? Looking back on it, it's the way the thing should. I mean, you should read the documents. You should read the whole thing. If you have a basis and you've told people why things might not occur that way, isn't that better disclosure than not giving them forward-looking disclosure, not saying here's what we think will happen? And that's the revolutionary change Alan was talking about. Is the change towards put information in and explain it. You know, there's so many sources of information now. It was a lot easier in the 60s and 70s in a way when that was the only document. Now you've got bloggers, you've got analysts, you've got people putting out information about here's where we see the company going. And to say the company's not able to say where it sees itself going, I don't think that the tension in that couldn't work anymore. And so I think Bespeak's caution was a good way to try to encourage people to do more. I don't know that it's encouraged them to do more. It's encouraged them to bespeak more. But hopefully it's had the positive effect.
Remember, too, that the courts are the ones that develop Bespeak's caution, not the commission.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
The commission essentially has played catch-up in the rules in order to build it into the rules because that's what the courts were finding.
Alan, do you have a strong view as to what brought about the shift toward forward-looking information?
Do I have a strong view? No. I think that view toward putting forward-looking information into prospectuses and in disclosure documents generally, its time had come, and the old view essentially just didn't make sense anymore. And Marty is right. With the additional sources of information, it became less and less relevant. And recognize also that the courts did beat the commission to the battle on that.
Well, you both mentioned, I think, that the division has been quite responsive to changes in the outside world and outside pressures, and I'm interested in your views on whether what changes the Internet hath wrought.
The Internet makes it very difficult to regulate. It really, the beginning of it, trying to figure out in the Internet world what's a public offering versus a private offering, who is speaking. The extent to which Internet is electronic communications and changing the rules just to get that within written or oral. There's a lot of details to that the commission has tackled. You know, it takes time to figure it out as you go, and you don't want to get it too wrong because it's tough to go back. But they have tackled all that, and they're all over it. And I think a realization is you had a choice when the Internet came along. Do you want to ignore it and give up and say, we can't regulate that, we can't fit it in our system, it's the Wild West? Or do you want to find a way to say, we recognize this is different? Let's find a way to fit it as best we can within where we are and be practical about it. So I think you've seen that on the regulatory side. On the reality side, I think the ability of just so many sources of information has, as we talked about before, changed the Commission's view that there shall be one document you shall read when you make your investment decision. They recognize that there are other pieces of information out there, and to say this is the one document and you can't say things in it just doesn't make sense. And so I think you've seen an expansion of what the staff will allow folks to put in documents. You know, free writing prospectuses. Allowing free writing prospectuses means you should allow that information in the prospectus itself. And so that opens everything up. So I give the commission and the staff a great deal of credit for not giving into the Internet and saying, this is too big for us. We can't handle it. Because there were some calls to do that. I remember that at the time. Just say, ooh, the Internet's out there. And I think it took time. Time went on. There were mistakes. There were fits and starts. But where CorpFin is on the Internet, coming out of securities offering reform and with free writing prospectuses and their general view of how it fits with general solicitation, I think they've done a very nice job of dealing with it. And I don't think it's going away. So, you know, I think they did well. Am I wrong, Alan?
No, you're never wrong.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
But, no, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. I think the one of the things that we haven't dealt with in the Internet era is having a basic core document that's available to the public, presumably on EDGAR or IDEA, whatever it is these days, that one can turn to, and one document in which one can have a high degree of confidence that this is the issue we're speaking, and God willing, this is the truth. And I have some sense that in the rush to financing and in the demand financing era of the 90s, the dot-com period, and the pressure to get deals through, and the Internet, and the multiple sources of information, and frankly, incorporation by reference, has made it increasingly difficult to have that one place that you can go and know you're getting the gospel truth, or we hope it's the truth, but getting it out of the issuer's mouth. And I think we've lost that to some degree. We've got a multiplicity of sources. We've got an endless number of blogs and commentators. But it's increasingly difficult to go to the horse's mouth.
Was that an expression of at least mild regret about incorporation by reference? Do you think?
I just think it's time had come. It certainly makes life easier. But it is a mild regret that it makes it more difficult to pick up one document each year and say, here's everything I need to know.
That is the challenge, because even the one document is supposed to be the 10K. You know, it's the source for everything. But even the realities, and again, the commission is to be credited for looking at the realities when they do it, is when you do your 10K, it comes in a set period of time, and then part three, which is the exec comp and all that, doesn't come in until the proxy, and it gets incorporated into the 10K. So there is never that one piece. EDGAR makes life so much easier that it's all there, and it's not in one document, but you can find it all.
Searchable.
I think EDGAR is perfectly searchable. But, you know, I mean, it's pretty predictable, and you know where to look for documents. The full-text search is incredibly helpful. I think incorporation had to happen. Alan's right, incorporation by reference. But I think more and more you can find everything online that you need to find, and it's on IDEA. And if I can just say one thing, getting rid of the name EDGAR, please. It's EDGAR. It's EDGAR. It should be EDGAR. And I'd like us to go back to that, but nobody asked me, so I'll leave that.
I'm also curious about how the electronic age has affected the division's own transparency as far as getting its stated word into print and into electronic form and disseminated amongst the eager populace. Has that been happening? And if so, is it a good thing or a bad thing?
I'll start. I remember there used to be something called the Telephone Interps Manual, and it was a notebook that had a bunch of pages stuck in, and you Xeroxed stuff on top of it, and it was purely a paper document. And it was available in the public reference room, and it was available in CorpFin. We had it. But not a lot of people knew it was there. And it was some of the interps looked like they'd been, you know, carved in stone and then copied in there. They were very old. And it wasn't widely disseminated. And so in the mid-90s, one of the first things we did is we put them all into a Word document, organized them all, and put them online. And put them up on the web when the web was very new, you know, the SEC website. And we all thought, isn't this a great idea? Because now they don't have to call and ask. They've got all the answers. Everybody has them. Everybody's got the same library. Well, what happened is we actually got more questions because people started asking us questions about the interps and said, what did you mean by this? What did you mean by that? So transparency, obviously a good thing, but it doesn't have the effect you want it to have, which is by giving everybody all the information, it doesn't make it easier for everybody. It has this unintended consequence of causing people to work towards these interps and forget what the bigger picture is, to cause the staff to live with interps. Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, and let's stop and go back. One of the things that the division has done, which is absolutely remarkable in one sense, is to develop and make public and make transparent various tools and various interpretations over the years. So we've got what Marty was just talking about with the telephone interps. We've got staff legal bulletins. We've got now got comment letters. We have no action letters. There was a time when a no action letter was totally private. Then it was public. Then it was public, 30 days later. Then it's public instantly. So we've got a situation where the staff has, over the years, made its thinking, and right up to the comment letters and responses, almost immediately available to everyone. It's hard to sit, and you sound like a Luddite when you sit and say, this isn't good. Yet there's a good argument, I think, a defensible argument to say one of the unintended consequences of leveling that playing field and making all that information available to anyone who wants it is that everybody plays to the test, as Marty said at one point. Everybody sits there at the staff side and at the bar side, at the council side, and sits there and says, here's the information, this is what I have to do. And instead of attempting to craft a creative solution or to deal with a one-off problem, I think both the inside and the outside of the building, but particularly the inside of the building, now has to stick with the established rule, principle, comment, whatever, that's been handed down in recent years. The result, and I don't think it helps the working relationship either, the result is that you get less and less thoughtful response because you've got people responding simply based on what's in the book. And I think that's unfortunate, and I think it frankly works to the detriment of the staff in a lot of respects because they're not forced to think. They're forced to look up and recite the answer that they can find in the book.
Yeah, I would agree. The level to which the staff has put its thinking out there is really remarkable. I mean, you go to the CorpFin website and you can find just about everything they've said on anything. It's really an amazing success story. The difficulty with it is it's the same as when the SEC adopted safe harbors, say. Used to be people argued, who's an underwriter? Now they argue, does this comply with 144? You know, I've lost track of my bigger picture and I'm now in the minutia. So when people come to the staff, to the staff's great credit, they're willing to have already said what they say, be willing to stand by it, and yet be trying to come up with an answer for what's going on. Yet they're being held to what's always there, and they know that any answer they give is now going to be out there. So people used to always refer to this is a one-off. It's a one-off situation. It's unique. It's strange. But it fits in this situation. Now if you do a one-off and it's in the phone interps, or you do a one-off and it gets in a blog and then a here and a there, suddenly you've got to live with it. And in every situation where you don't want to give what you just gave, you now have to explain why not. And that's a lot of pressure when you're just trying to come up with the right answer. And so I think the transparency, if you were to balance positives and negatives, hugely positive. The difficulty, though, of the pressure that puts the staff under it's not to be ignored, and it's a real stressful part of it. And the fact that they're still able to give as many answers as they do and plow ahead shows that they know what's going on and are very good at knowing why those answers were there. But when you're on the outside reading it, you just read the answer. And you're like, why didn't you give me this? Why won't you give me this again? And I think it's had its downsides.
You both mentioned a couple of times, I think, the offering reforms, and I assume that you were thinking, at least in part, about the changes adopted back in 2005. At least some people have written that they have greatly complicated understanding of the federal securities laws. It may be simpler for issuers to live within practice, but actually understanding what's going on may be more challenging than ever before. Were those changes basically driven by a game of catch-up with the outside world and what's going on with the Internet, or was there indeed something loftier and more theoretical going on?
The latter. There was something more lofty, I would hope. It was a lot of effort if it wasn't. But the reality of that was that there are certain levels of offerings in which Section 5 doesn't really provide the benefit it needs to be there to do. The advanced staff review doesn't provide what it wouldn't provide any benefit that's worth the candle, to use Alan Beller's phrase. And so really in that, it was a look at in what areas, and it was much more than sand in the gears, but some of it was just sand in the gears. At what areas are we throwing sand in the gears for no resulting benefit? And also, the bigger picture of all that was there were two things to the 2005. One is we got the sand in the gears out. But I truly think the most important thing that came of that was Rule 159, which says, you know, when you assess liability for your disclosure to somebody, we'll make it easier for you to disclose. We'll give you free writing prospectuses. We will allow incorporation by reference. We won't make you satisfy Section 5 in certain circumstances. But when somebody makes their investment decision, that's when whatever you've given them will be judged for liability purposes. Not after, not stuff you make up in a final, not all that. And so saying, let's ease this process. Let's throw this much more wide open for the largest of companies, but say it's a real process liability-wise in 159. That, I think, was the loftier piece, was saying ease process, but make the liability lines clear. And give people the benefit. I always thought that was the best part of the 2005 piece. And as far as being more difficult, there's some safe harbors in there that you really got to get into 5A and 5C and get all through that. But I think for the larger companies, more than anything else, it didn't really make it harder.
I couldn't agree more that it didn't make it harder for the companies that have to deal with it. It makes it harder to read and understand securities laws because it's complicated and there's a lot of referencing back and forth. It's not the world's finest example, I suppose, of making it user-friendly. But it works, and it's for the companies to which it was directed. It's an incredible boon and simplifies their life. I've always thought that in addition to 159, the introduction of real scalability in securities offering reform, we've always had small business forms. We've long had small business forms, but this was really the beginning of an era of scalability in terms of what, four different levels at least, of what companies could do and what levels of flexibility they had in the offering process. And I think that's been a major plus.
Does that mean that there's not just a double standard, but maybe a triple or a quadruple standard?
Well, there is a quadruple. There's at least a triple, maybe a quadruple standard. But it may be deserved. I mean, the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, that the division's mission is disclosure. You look to see where the risk is and where the disclosures are necessary and where the more complete and current disclosure is required. And you're looking at where the fraud is, frankly. And when you do that, I think you conclude that scalability works, and maybe having a double standard or a triple standard or a quadruple standard makes some degree of sense. It is unquestionably the case that the small business community feels put upon because it never gets a break. And it clearly feels that way, and it clearly feels that the big boys with the high-power lawyers come in and get all the breaks. On the other hand, I think there's a flip side to that, which is where the problems are.
You mean with the small issuers?
Yeah, I mean, what I really mean is when the staff sits back and says, where should we add some flexibility into the process? Can we do this? These people want general solicitation. They want this, they want that, whatever it is at any given moment. The staff has to sit back and say, what are the risks to the investment community of allowing this additional flexibility? I think when you were dealing with the Tier 1 companies, you conclude that there's not much risk to the investment community. When you're dealing with other companies further down in that quadruple level, maybe the staff sits there and looks at its data and its statistics and concludes, you know, we better not loosen up here because we need to hold these folks' feet to the fire. I've never been in that meeting, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's what happens.
Well, then you get my experience in the 1990s was there was a big push to do small business reforms. And we created new forms, created new disclosure requirements, everything else. We eased up on Regulation D, 504 particularly. And everybody like, oh, great idea. And then within 3 years, there's a hearing on the Hill about what are you doing about microcap fraud? You know, and I think the reality with small businesses is there's no perfect line. You can never hit it quite right because depending on how the economy is and everything else, that line keeps moving. And I think the best you can do is hope to hopscotch over it and keep getting closer because no matter what, you're never going to be right depending on the economy.
And let's be candid about it. The pendulum swings back and forth.
Absolutely.
So it
you got political
from,
and economic.
Yeah, politically, economically, where how the staff, how the leadership of the commission feels at any given moment. And it swings back and forth between encouraging finance and not trying to chase business offshore and opening. Look at 144A, which, you know, basically was, as I understand it, see, it was a reaction to the concern that there was a lot of flight capital going out of the U.S. So you sit there and say you go from one era to a much more highly regulatory environment. Not a surprise, and probably a reasonably healthy tension that will continue over the years.
Alan, Marty got a shot at this earlier to say what he thought CorpFin should do if it had all the money, suddenly had all the money in the world.
Declare a dividend.
Is that really what you'd say if I gave you the same question?
No, probably not. I would think that probably training, and I'm probably with Marty on it. I think staff training. I think maybe salary increases to increase the retention rates so we had more career and experienced people in the divisions and in the division and better trained people in the division, I think would be critical. I haven't heard many complaints lately about technology, but I do think that keeping good people is extraordinarily valuable. I don't get the feeling, and I haven't looked lately, but I don't get the feeling that the number of lifers in the division today is what it was some years ago. It'll be good for a few years now, given the economy. But having a senior staff who are there and who are effective and who are motivated and who are well compensated and well trained and experienced is enormously valuable.
Alan and Marty, both of you, thank you for sharing your invaluable insights into the work of CorpFin with us today. This program is now added to the important collection of materials on the work of the SEC Division of Corporation Finance, already in the Virtual Museum and Archive, including the March 2004 program on safe harbors, the June 2007 program on regulation of global securities offerings, and oral history interviews with former CorpFin directors and staff, including Mickey Beach, Ed Green, Alan Levinson, and Richard Rowe. Today's program can be accessed again on demand in the online programs section of the museum, in both MP3 and transcript format. Next month, I'll moderate a special online program on international financial regulation on Tuesday, March 10th, beginning at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, with two of my fellow professors, Lawrence Cunningham and Arthur Wilmarth. This program will be broadcast in place of the previously scheduled March 12th program. In April, the Fireside Chats will return with the April 21st chat on the SEC Office of the Chief Accountant with John Albert of the SEC staff and Gary Previtz, professor at Case Western University. Both programs will be free and accessible worldwide without prior registration. Please plan to join us again on www.sechistorical.org on March 10th. Thank you for being with us today.